This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Terra Nova Earth Talks. We speak with cutting-edge experts and wise elders from across the globe on the issues and action our Earth is calling for. Brought to you by the Terra Nova Foundation, driving environmental change through human connection and collective action.
Welcome to Terra Nova Earth Talks. Today we dive into the world of forests and forest restoration and the role of digital tools in the natural world. We consider whether they have a role to play and how they can be activated to help save our Earth. Our forests are under threat in more ways than one. It is not simply because people are clearing forests for rapidly expanding agribusiness, mining, and other industries, although this reason is perhaps the most easily seen, tragic, and preventable. They are also under threat because of the push to plant plantations, the extreme fire events, the pollution of soils and water, and the rise of unchecked pests. But perhaps they are under threat the most because of the way we, as a species, have diminished their value to purely financial and become disconnected, distracted, and selfish in our attitude towards them. There is a need for us to know the significant role that forests play around the world. They are not just necessary for reducing carbon. They are the lungs of the earth. She cannot breathe well without them. Mother Earth is gasping more and more, and yet we continue our behaviour with the foolishness and attitude of the onceler. And if you haven't read The Lorax, then please do, because that's a reference to the onceler in that. Forests are also the home to an extraordinary biodiversity of animals, insects, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, and to the most mind-boggling array of flora, underground and above ground, in our oceans. So, the challenge is on. Not only do we need to stop our unforgivable clearing of forests and irresponsible developments of plantations, we need to undertake substantial redress. This means the restoring of forests around the world as quickly as we can and as effectively as we can. We need support for the guardians of our land and our oceans with the resources they need to restore. This will include planting of trees, but most critically, it needs to include the restoration of the forest ecosystems by those who have the knowledge of those forest lands and waters. How do we find those people so we can support them? How do we get the resources to them? How do we ensure that we can accelerate the genuine restoration of our forests around the world? Is there a way to move the resources to empower the guardians of our forests around the world through digital means? Well, today we are most fortunate to have a green digital powerhouse joining us from Lausanne in Switzerland. He is the CEO and co-founder of the Open Forest Protocol, or OFP, a global platform to transparently measure, verify, and fund forestation projects. He is a board member of the Swiss Green FinTech Network and has co-founded a non-profit organization to enable more investment into localized reforestation projects. He has been working tirelessly to open the channels of possibility for reforestation and activating support and resources for the incredible guardians and warriors on the ground, making it happen. We welcome today Fred Fournier.
Hello, Rose.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
It was wonderful to have you. This is a fascinating topic and incredibly urgent in this world. It kind of gets forgotten sometimes. So it's a pleasure to have you here to talk to it.
The pleasure is mine. Happy to be here. And looking forward to the discussion.
So then, let's talk forests and reforestation. You have seen the issues up close and personally. What can you tell us about the challenges we are facing with our forests around the world?
Yeah, well, As you described before, you know, forests are under threats in most countries, most regions of the world, for various reasons. One of the reasons that is really visible is that us humans are we need the resources of the forest to survive in some cases, to thrive in other cases, and to also get a lot of resources, maybe not in a very fair manner always, but I think it's a tremendous resource for us. It could be you know, generating a lot of revenue or generating just downtime for working in the forest. So yeah, there's a lot of different use of forest, and obviously the most important one is that it's an ecosystem in itself, like you know, like the ocean or other ecosystem, and that ecosystem is under threat. I think one thing that happened is that we are more and more disconnected with the environment as a whole, as humans, and of course with forests. So I'd say most people now see forests either as something, you know, that they don't connect with because they live in city, or they see that as, strictly speaking, as a resource for making money or to produce paper or wood. But it's very important to realize that there is a need to find a balance and an equilibrium between those the ecosystem and us. And what I have seen without my own eyes, and many people have seen that, is the sad destruction of forest. It could be, you know, on a, as you said, on a very clear way to plant soya, to plant palm oil, to you know, do some big agribusiness, but it's also sad to see, you know, smallholders deforesting because they need the wood to cook their meal, or they just need to clear up the land to make sure they can plant stuff. So it's a threat all over the world. But at the same time, we also see, especially now, probably in the last 10, 15 years, a strong push towards stopping deforestation on one side, and also trying to restore forest. Of course, we see a lot of tree planting organization and activities. And I think we have basically a very good and solid ground of organizations that are trying to do this work on the ground and put this effort forward. We, however, lack you know, the structured way on how to do this in the right way.
So we're going to dive into that, because I can't wait to start talking about that as a challenge. But I want to wind back a little bit, because to the disconnect. Sometimes I look at the forest from a worldwide human perspective. It's almost like we're going to the supermarket. It's like a wooden paper supermarket, and we just fill up the trolley, and we keep going back, and we just fill up the trolley, and we at no point are we actually looking at the supermarket as anything other than just that big resource pool for us. And I think that's maybe some of our attitude, is like, that's, we're allowed to do that, you know, because we need the paper or we need the wood. But do you think that it feels like almost insatiable need for paper and wood really driving the forest bit, or is it more complex than that?
It's probably a lot more complex, because it's a lot more localized most of the time. So, you know, it's hard to say this. The reason for the threat on the forest is this or that specifically, but of course, I would say if you take it from a very high perspective, the whole society is consuming more and more, more oil, more gas, more wood, more resources as a whole. It doesn't matter if it's wood or not, but I think as societies, we have defined our happiness in regards of what we own or what we can consume, mostly. And I think this is driving everyone to actually consume more, and it's driving the threat on the environment as a whole. And of course, forest being part of one of those resources is under threat, as all other resources in the world.
I have to say, in Aotearoa, New Zealand, we do a lot of building with wood. which is not always usual yeah. in the rest of the world, but we do do it here. And I see these huge houses being built, you know. And so one is the wood being used sometimes to build the house. But then, of course, if it's off the grid or, you know, out of the city a bit, then there's now a wood fire in there. And many big houses have big wood burners. So it's almost like we're sometimes building the very thing to, you know, keep increasing that consumerism. You know, we keep locking ourselves into the inevitable, oh, we have, you know, I need that to keep our house warm type mentality, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, at the same time, you know, if you think at wood from an impact perspective, it's a very sustainable resource. So if it's managed well, and you do you have people that do that really well, and companies that do that really well, where they do have FSC standards or PFC standards. So if the forest is managed well, it's an extremely sustainable resources. So I think if you compare that to concrete or other type of constructions or energy, for instance, oil and gas, if managed well, it's actually really, really, really better than what we would use otherwise. Nice.
So I think it's this balance
right? I was talking yeah. about. Yeah.
And also, I'm just going to pick up, you said FFC and PEFC, stewardship.
Stewardship or standards, yes.
That tells us that there's a degree of verification that the wood has been planted, grown, and cut sustainably. Is that correct?
Yes. It actually means that the forest is managed in a sustainable way, meaning that you don't do clear cuts. So you actually leave trees in the forest that regenerates the forest. You do only small cuts here and there. So it's a way to manage the forest where you make sure that, you know, biodiversity on one side, but also the forest is still, you know, an environment, an ecosystem, and not destroyed and replanted.
So that mark is on everything, right? So I often say to people, look for that mark on your stationery, look for that mark on your on the piece of furniture you bought, or, you know, look for that mark. If it hasn't got that mark, then there's no guarantee it has come from a sustainable source, essentially.
Yeah. And to make the point here, when you buy wood, it's very important that, you know, those labels are there. Why? Because eventually, if they're not there, you might end up buying wood that is coming from a tropical forest and even a protected tropical forest. You know, I've talked to quite a few projects where we realized that the local population were actually selling their wood to big companies, timber companies. The timber company will go in the forest, harvest whatever they want, and actually the most precious wood, and then they would walk out and leave. Right. And that's an enormous damage when that happened for everyone.
Yeah, right. So it becomes important noticing these marks and paying attention. It's when we blindly go into things that is really difficult to manage, you know. So, yeah, so let's now I'm really keen for you to talk. So you started to talk about some of the challenges of the infrastructure, and actually there are people out there doing some amazing stuff in terms of restoration of forests and protection as well, because both go hand in hand. So tell me more, because this is – and I'd love to know your kind of lead-in story to how you ended up working with some of these groups.
I'm a scientist, but not a forest scientist. I'm a water scientist, but my forest has been my gig since I was a kid. I got to start a small Swiss NGO supporting sustainable reforestation projects about 6 years back, So we started, you know, talking to projects around the world, defining which project we wanted to fund and support technically. And eventually we ended up talking to actually dozens and dozens of projects. And so the first kind of surprise and good thing was that we found a lot. We found hundreds of projects. So we were like, oh, this is interesting. Loads of people are actually doing something, either restoration, conservation. But what we also found out was the fact that most of those projects, you know, they are pretty much underfunded. They are not well equipped. They don't have the right, necessarily always the right resources. And eventually we found out that the reporting from the projects to us was pretty poor, or in some cases non-existent. And they were not able to also access carbon finance. And that's something we will, you know, deep dive into later. But so we found a situation where, you know, there were hundreds of projects worldwide, and we were like trying to pick a few ones to help, which was a very difficult exercise. At the same time, it was quite reassuring to see that. But then we felt a bit lost on how to do this, right? So this was kind of the beginning of the story of how we got to build this data infrastructure called Open Forest Protocol that I will explain a bit further too. But so I think just if we stop on that for a second, it's very interesting that you know, local populations, most of them got a sense that, you know, you have to protect forests. They don't necessarily know how. They don't necessarily are in the position to do it because they need the resource. You know, they need the wood somehow. So I think we are in a spot where there's a lot of possibilities out there. It's just hard to make them happen.
Yeah, most places. I've seen this a lot across a lot of issues, right, where there's a lot of local will. There's a lot of local good intent. There's a lot of local projects as well, but that's hard. That's harder than perhaps coming in and just throwing resource at a big project. You know, I quite often see these big global projects that come in on top of almost the local environment and go, let's restore thousands of hectares of whatever, and it might sound really impressive, but that is hugely problematic after that point, right? Because what happens after you've planted a whole, who's going to look after it? So it sounds impressive, but the reality of the long-term impact is a lot different. And so when you do the local bit, you start to, it's a lot of work up front because you need to know who they are, you need to get to know them, you need to know what's happening, and that's all quite intense work and takes a lot longer, but the long-term likelihood, or it reduces the risk, let's say, of actually those being maintained and integral for generations to come, as opposed to some of the massive ones that come in and kind of come and go. Have you found that?
Yeah, it's hard to have a really clear view on this. I mean, my perception would be the same, but I don't have data to prove it or
or to, the scientist is in the room.
Yeah, it's
well done.
Yeah, it's more of a feeling. But no, I think what's very important here, and what you said is completely right, is that for any projects, any size of a project, to be successful, especially when you work with nature, you have to think long term, and you have to think incentive for the locals for the long term, right? So, be the project huge, I guess it's going to be harder to incentivize everyone in this big project for the long term than if you have a small project, one or two farmers to incentivize for the long term, because you know you won't have the same dynamics and the same risk in a project. So I think it's hard to say, you know, a project above X size is going to fail or not, but at least the very important point is incentivization of a project. What actually as a project operator, someone who actually restore nature, what do I get out of that? If it's just, you know, because you really believe in protecting nature and restoring nature, you'll do it anyway, whatever the incentive is, right? For most people, you need some sort of financial incentive or recognition incentive, but I would say mostly financial, especially in the developing countries.
Yeah.
So how do you make that happen, you know, at the ground level, at the farmer level? How do you make this even possible, which is it's not possible today, right? So what we have thought of doing when we started our small NGO was to say, okay, we have a huge issue. We can help, you know, maybe 5, 10 projects. That's great. But how would you actually fix the whole incentive approach for all those farmers who eventually would be the best people to have access to carbon finance, but they can't because it's too complex, it's too costly, they don't have the resources, their projects are too small, so on and so forth. So that's the question we really ask ourselves, and eventually came up with an answer.
And Very good answer, I must say. So yeah, tell me more about your answer, because it's exciting project and organization, I must say.
Yeah, so our vision was to basically think about two essential things that every market needs. The first thing is the trust and the transparency, or the transparency and the trust. You never know which one goes first, but you know, you really need to have that. So when you fund a project, being buying carbon credits or sending philanthropic or sending funds just to support a project, you really need to understand where this money is going and what you get back, right? And because we're mostly working with projects, you know, on the ground somewhere in a remote place, the link between whoever is doing the work on the ground and whoever is funding it is basically the trust. And how do you get that trust is through data. It's the only way, right? It's the only possible link that you can find. So if you think about data and data for forests, what does it mean? It means actually that you know that whatever activities you have on the ground, that you can follow this activity. So if we take planting trees, you know, you'll plant trees, let's say today, you might have, you know, some information about how that goes, but you need that information in a year from now, and then 2 years from now, and then 10 years from now, and so on. So how do you make that happen so the trust can stay for the long term, and how, and also how the person on the ground keeps the motivation high to make sure that the restoration effort is for the long term, the trees are growing and they're safe. So
they're getting some sort of recompense, you know, like there's a, like back to your incentive thing, like there's a loop here, you know, it's not just goodwill.
Exactly. So in simple words, what we have come up with is a way for people on the ground to access mostly simplified digital tools, simple digital tools to capture data from their activities from the ground, get that data verified by third parties, so a community of third parties that is checking this data, and if the data is accepted or verified in a positive way by the community of third party verifiers, that data could, you know, generate value in the forms of carbon credits in this case. Or other environmental digital assets in the future, if you think about biodiversity or other things that don't exist today, but that the whole community is talking about today.
So that's a high integrity of data, right? So that because quite often the relationship between, particularly if I'm quite aware of, say, philanthropic lines. And often it's quite linear, you know, you have to trust the data all along the line and back again. But you have put in place this significant digital infrastructure to verify so that trust can be really significant as the data passes through, right?
Yes, exactly. So the data that is collected on the ground on a regular basis, so it's roughly every year, it's actually every year for the duration of the project, is verified every time it's collected. If the data doesn't pass the test, because let's say the trees are not there, there was a fire, or they've been cut down, or there is a drought, whatever, then the data set is not verified, doesn't create value, for instance. If it's verified as being valid, then the value creation happens, and most of the value created in the form of carbon credits goes back to the project, and then they have their value in their hands, and they can sell it to the market. And because that's happening on a regular basis, then what's very interesting is that it's creating an incentive for the people on the ground to do their job well. Because they are responsible for it, and to get the value every year, if it's verified. So it creates a long-term incentive on one side for the people to continue doing the good work on the ground,
right,
and from the people on the other side by getting the asset or wanting to fund the project to have the trust that they do a good job because everything is transparent.
Right.
They can check on our platform that the data has been uploaded, if it was validated or not. So it's fully open and fully transparent.
Right. It's quite a bit different to projects that I've seen in the past, right? That just, you know, where a lot of the time money's been invested or gifted in the hope that it goes well. and then the money moves on because there's no loop, you know, so the philanthropist or the funder or the investor gets something new to invest in because it's like, oh, well, you know, we had a go at that. But this enables that back communication to tell you it's a good investment or that philanthropically you've made a real difference, which is wonderful. Now, I want to pick up on the transparency bit, but first I think might be useful. One of the things about the Open Forest Protocol is it's open source and decentralized. Can you give some insight into why this is particularly important?
Yes, it's extremely important for us because I think when you're dealing with nature, which is a common good, you have to think about how you work with a common good in an open way, right? So the way we look at this is that the data that is collected by the people verified, it's completely transparent, but it's also open. What it means that actually you have access to the data set. It's not owned by someone. Ultimately, the data is immutable because it's on blockchain, but the very important thing is that if someone wants to use that data set for research, for doing something else, they can actually use it.
Right.
So common goods for us equals an open business model. And an open business model doesn't mean that we have a few things that are, you know, proprietary to make the system work. You know, there are a few, especially the verification system is proprietary. So there is a logic where the verifiers also, you know, reserving the share of the value created. But ultimately, once completely launched, our approach or open source approach could be used by someone else wanting to do something with, let's say, peatland. Mm. They could say, okay, well, I'd like to build a vertical, as we call it. So basically a solution for doing the same thing that OFP does with forest, but for peatland. And I'm going to use the same data infrastructure. And they're welcome to do that because it's been built for that purpose.
Right. Yeah. So that's and I'm guessing like many digital tools like this, as soon as they're open source, it encourages others to be more innovative as well because they're not starting from scratch every time. You've got some data to work with, which then goes, right, well, how can we use this for other applications? So the innovation tends to pump up and up and up, which cannot, you know, can only surely be a good thing if it's being put to good use, of course.
Yes, totally. It's what we hope, and we've already seen a few interests. Actually, one interest from a person wanted just an Australian guy, by the way, wanted to build the mangrove vertical with us. So I think it's going to be, you know, this next generation of young people, I think, is really keen on working more collaboratively than we were. Also because, you know, they have the tools, they have the mindset. And that's, I mean, it's going to be changing the way we work in a sense, slowly but surely.
Yeah, I find it really exciting because there's nothing more frustrating when you're trying to, you know, build a digital twin or something like this and someone's just holding on to their data set and they won't let it go. And you're like, oh, God, this is not helpful. It's, you know, keep your proprietary stuff, you know, that's fine. You're all good. But let the data go because the data is important for everybody. So I want to move on to the transparency bit. So can you give a little bit of an example to how the transparency may also help the person on the ground with the forest? So you've talked a little bit about the other end, but I'm presuming the transparency also helps them as well with the work that they're doing.
Yes, definitely. I think if you think of an NGO in Africa or South America, actually, it doesn't matter exactly where, but you know, their business model has been to, on I would say, an annual or biannual basis to look for funds most of the time. I'm not even talking about farmers, which don't have access to that. But so they've been looking for funds, and when they get, you know, a fair amount of funds, then they do their activities, and then they get to a stop and they start again, right? So I think being transparent about what they do is extremely important, because it puts them in a place where, you know, they are by essence more trusted. Because if you're open to be, you know, analyzed, scrutinized, and to let other people see that, you know, you're human, you might do some mistakes, that's fine, but at least you are starting on by saying, okay, I'm going to try to do this, those activities, it might be risky, but I'm going to do it in an open way, a trustworthy way. So it feels like you're honest from the start, and you might fail. Okay, that might happen. At least you're going to fail honestly. And not trying to say, oh, no, something else happened or whatever. Try to come up with a story. The story is going to be, you know, I planted trees, or I did try to restore and something came up. And then you can see, obviously, that it failed. Or on the other side, everything goes well and it's going according to plan, and then I'm happy and everything is thriving, and I can scale my operations and so on. So I think starting a project in this spirit is actually giving whoever actually is the investor or the funders, or even a volunteer, someone who wants to help without even giving money, I think it's a different visibility and different start in the communication, in the relationship, and financial or not.
Sometimes people say to me, oh, but you need to, you know, the only way to see it is to actually see it with your own eyes. But of course, this is not possible nor do we want everyone flying around the world, by the way, to visit their forests that they're investing in. So this also enables that kind of transparency without having to see it with your own eyes as well, or meet the people face to face, which I think is important, because one of the things, particularly in the past, there might be one supporter of a project, you know, one main supporter. But now we need multiple supporters. We need people from all around the world investing in this in one way or another. So it gives that opportunity to have those channels in. So it gives it a good shot. Because to go back to what I said in the introduction, we need a lot of restoration and new forests, essentially, to start to counter some of the destruction that we've been doing. Even if we behave perfectly from now on, we've still got a lot of redress to put in place. So I think that, to me, that's kind of the joy of it too. It just enables people to get involved by seeing something on their laptop or on their computer, you know.
Totally. And I think, you know, once you have the right incentive in place, then, and you, of course, you have the human aspect at the center, then you can use tech, not the other way around. What I mean by that is, I've seen a lot of startups trying to build something with tech only, not thinking necessarily about, you know, how it would actually be used by the people, how it's going to be impacting the long term of the project or not, which is, you know, and I'm not saying this is something you shouldn't do, because the tech is super important. But for us, it's the human approach is central. And then we use tech. We use tech to make sure that the data that they collect on the ground is coming from the ground in specific locations in the forest. We make sure that they can cheat on that part. We make sure that this data is verified by third parties, and actually we have dozens of them with, you know, quite some complex mechanism, but at the end it's a private vote by all those the third parties. And we make sure that the value goes back to the project. So this is all about tech. And we are only able to do that today. We were not able to do that 10 years back. So that's the beauty of, you know, building something like that today. But, you know, let's not forget that the people on the ground are the one planting, are the one taking care of the trees, are the one not cutting them, or are the one watering them. That's the very important piece. And then put the tech on top to make sure everything, all this data, actually makes sense and is linked to the activities, and make sure that this data translate into a value proposition for the buyer, so the supporter.
That's a wonderful, that's a wonderful point, because one of the things that comes up quite often with the hackathons and, or the, you know, the, lots of ideation about what can digital do, and now of course with AI, you know, what can AI do for the world? But there's that missing point. So people are diving in with all the tools without actually having a context which shows tools can be used in. So the context and what is actually going on the ground is critical for a tool to be useful. You know, there's no point in me bringing a chainsaw to a flower garden. You know, you need to know what you're working with and actually have the tech that's going to accelerate or leverage or whatever it is that you're trying to do to what exists and what is needed. And I think that's, to me, the work that you've put into working out that bit is the significant bit. You haven't just gone, oh, I've come up with a good idea to help, you know, some forests come about. You've met, you knew people, you watched, you researched, you spent huge amounts of time actually investigating what is happening in reality.
I think, you know, you need people that dive into tech and come up with great ideas and awesome new ways of doing things and coding things. That's great. You know, you really need that. But AI is never going to plant a tree and restore a forest. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So you have to think about those two things together. If you think just on one side or the other, I don't think you'll go really far. That's my view anyway. It might change, you know, we never know. You know, maybe robots will do that in the future.
Well, that's what I say. So that there's talk of, you know, planting plantations. But that's, the point is we're looking at the actual ecosystem of the forest rather than just purely planting trees in a lot of these instances as well. It's not just about setting the world up to deal with the carbon issue, because that's back to the human want, if you like. It's actually addressing the ecosystems of the earth, our host, our support to exist that needs the breakthrough.
Yeah. And then in that sense, one of the type of projects I like the most are agroforestry projects where you have farmers, you know, planting coffee or tea or those sort of things, and then, or cocoa. And then the value proposition with them or other farmers is to say, okay, why don't you plant, you know, a few other trees that will help, you know, your crop grow and, I mean, eventually be more resilient. You will have those trees that are going to be there. They will provide shades. They provide more biodiversity. They provide eventually, you know, some additional revenue in the form of carbon. So it's slowly rebuilding something more more in equilibrium. It's not restoring a full forest, but still, you know, that this is a small step in the right direction. We've seen now a few NGOs we've talked to. You know, saying, we want to do carbon. How do we do that? Okay, so we explain that, you know, you can do carbon if you're planting, let's say pears or rambutans, so I don't know what. You know, you have to restore something. And then we came up with ideas where you say, okay, but your farmers, you know, can continue doing their activities. That's fine. But what about the restore parts of the land? Because they always have, you know, some part of the land that is degraded. What about, you know, restoring a forest, doing a secondary forest, plant a diverse, and then there's not a lot of work. I mean, replanting is some work, but then there's an interesting revenue by planting a secondary forest, monitoring this forest, getting some carbon revenue. And then on the ground, it means actually that you are restoring biodiversity in an ecosystem that where biodiversity was lost. So And more than that, it's creating an interest for the farmers to take care of that forest, to do some work around that forest, to see the benefit of it, and then think about, you know, long term, the next generation will come, and what will they do? Will they cut down the forest that, you know, the dad or the granddad has planted, or will they take care of that? So it's even more than just trees. It's education. It's a whole
opening up possibilities. Yeah.
So yeah, it's very interesting to sense that. I mean, we're still very early in that sense.
Mm.
But this is very important for not only us, for our next generations.
Yeah, nice. Now, I want to just tap into your insight, because you've been in this game, if you like, a long time, and doing all sorts of innovations, and which has ended up with the Open Forest Protocol. But what do you consider to be the most critical actions that we need to take for our forests around the world? Is it stopping their destruction and poisoning? Is it channeling investments to our forest guardians? What do you think has to happen over the next 5 years? Because I think the next 5 years is pretty critical time.
Yeah, we have to do a lot of things. I think, stopping deforestation is probably the most crucial one. However, it's not always the top priority. It really depends on the country you are or the jurisdiction you are in. So let's take Brazil. Yeah, Brazil is a pretty obvious thing. You know, deforestation has to be stopped, and also starting restoration. In other countries, what's very critical is to protect forest, because most of the forest is still standing, but there is more and more pressure on using the resources from the forest. So there, it's more kind of a protection vision. And so in some other countries, like Ivory Coast, I'll give you one example, it's a country where the forest is almost gone. Mm. There's no natural, I mean, there's maybe a few percentage of the country which was previously covered by, you know, tropical forest that is remaining. In those countries, you need to restore forest.
Mm.
Super important too. And they do have a plan, a strategic plan in place in Ivory Coast to do that. So it's really linked to where you are. If you go to the Congo Basin, it's not the same logic as Brazil or Ivory Coast or in Asia in some places. So we'll have to look at what's needed there. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm not the one saying what we should do or not. People locally know what they have to do or not.
Mm.
Most people do. Mm. The question is, it's a tension between people wanting to make money by getting those resources and people who want to protect them, those resources.
Mm.
So it's the same thing like in every market. There's a tension between the two. And of course, politics is a big thing. Mm. It's not an easy subject. There's usually lots of tension, and if you are, a person trying to protect the forest in certain countries, it's quite risky too. So you don't take that serious. You don't take that lightly. It could be a serious matter.
Yeah, and I do have to weigh in on that we have seen activists disappear and die in protection of forests around the world. So in some places, it's incredibly fragile and vulnerable for those trying to do that. So, but then equally in other countries, it's, like ours, we're in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and so we don't have those same risks to that degree, at least. And it's more about just purely being willing to do it. Maybe reduce the bottom line, the financial bottom line, a little. But, help us survive as a species. That would be good. And also, I think going back to what you were saying before about the flowing through for people to come, one of the things that's done here quite successfully is putting, once restorations happen, is covenant, what we call covenanting, which is putting those forests into protection for perpetuity, so that someone can come along and just cut down that beautifully restored forest if they buy the property. For some reason, land shifts into a different type of ownership. So So there's things that we can definitely do to help activate the protections and encourage restoration as governments, as, you know, national movements, all of those things. There's, you know, work that can be done. So to say, to reiterate what you said, it's in some places it's not, certainly not a light topic. It's a very difficult and can be tragic topic. And I do, the other thing we haven't mentioned at all is the extreme events, and I'm wondering if you've had thought on that. We have seen rampant fires across some of our big forest areas. Now, this is not to say that forest fires don't happen. They do. It's often a normal event for there to be a fire, but the extent and the speed and say voraciousness of the fire is significantly higher than it's ever been. We're not likely to see any let up on that. Unless we start to really alter how we view the forest. Have you had some thoughts on the fire and the extreme element, extreme events?
Yeah. I think the first thing to acknowledge is that, you know, forest fires have always been around. You know, it's not a new thing. Mm. It's actually a good thing for forests to, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a good thing when you have huge fires like last year in Canada or this year in Canada or things like that. No, but, you know, fires are, in a way, when they are under control and not too huge, a good thing for nature. Actually, if, of course, not destroying our homes and things like that, they might be beneficial from an ecosystem point of view. However, forest fires have been bigger, you know, become bigger and bigger, and eventually, you know, completely out of control. And I think, of course, climate change is one of the reason. And it's also, the way I see it, it's also a good reason for us to put more effort, interest, knowledge into forests, because eventually, from a scientific perspective, the only thing we know for sure is that a more biodiverse forest will be more resistant than a forest that has been replanted by us, you know, with one single species. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important for us as humans to know how to restore forests well, in a good way, not just to make profits or maximize the profit, but also think about what we actually want to restore. Mm-hmm. What is a good forest? So, you know, there are practices that needs to be tested out, that need to be thought through, not just purely from a financial perspective. I think that's very important, and I think restoration of forests is going to become more and more important with climate change. Not the opposite, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one of the things that we've seen over and over again is where you have an actual forest rather than a plantation. Plantations are just so problematic in so many ways, including fires. But where you actually have a forest where it's biodiversity, where it's ecosystems, where, you know, it's thick. It's a thick forest. You know, when you go into a thick forest, it's full of all sorts of things. That actually helps to slow down a fire. You know, it's likely to replenish quicker, all of these things. One of the things I wanted to note too is I've used the word guardian quite deliberately. We need to also be able to pass on the knowledge of the land through generations, and we're starting to lose that in a lot of areas around the world. And that, because that knowledge of the land and the water and the oceans, for that matter, by people is critical to know what is a good forest in that area or, you know, in the region, and how to work with the rhythms of the earth. So one of the things I think is that passing on of knowledge from the people who are doing it to the next generation and to the next and so on. And so one of the other, I think, like added value to the work that you're doing is you're nurturing those people. You're not just incentivizing, you're actually nurturing that knowledge so it can be passed on. They're not leaving and losing that knowledge from the land.
Totally. I think if we want to adapt to the conditions, to climate change, that's super important. It's not only in forests, it's in every ecosystem. We basically have to get more knowledge, but also to transmit that knowledge. And there's a lot to do. So it's very important to start and then continue. You know, I've seen so many people trying to learn something on the internet. Well, actually, you know, it's not there that you will. I mean, you will learn a few things, but when it comes to actually taking care of the land, you have to go out there and then you have to try it and fail and try it again. And that's basically the only way to get that knowledge, really.
The proper connection. Now, we've just got one last question, and it's a question we ask every single guest, because through your work, you have great insights. So, and we always like to labor on what people can do. Because it's great talking about all this stuff, and we've talked about how people could invest in what you're doing with the Open Forest Protocol, which we will share those details on our website and also on the podcast so that people can link up with you. But as an individual, is there something that you think, you know, what action could I take? Is there something I can do?
Yeah, I think if you like your environment, you like forest, and you've never planted a tree yourself, you know, think about doing it. Think about doing it for, you know, something special, maybe, you know, a birthday or whatever the reason is, you know, find a good reason. I've done that when I was a kid with my dad, and it's something that sticks. Why? Because you would find a connection with that tree or that moment or that place. That is quite special, and I think it's a good way to feel that connection. And whenever you feel lost in this, you know, environment where there's so much happening around you, right? You know, you're always under pressure. You always get loads of messages, information. It's good to have a few things in your life where it relates to something that is not linked to that. It's linked to a different timing. You know, it's linked to something else that is beyond just, you know, what's immediate in life.
I like that. That's very cool. I've just done an example of that, I hope, because we got a very small Christmas tree, live Christmas tree, not cut down, for my son. And it's very small. It's only like, oh, I don't know, it's about 50 centimeters, I guess, somewhere there. It's very small. But we said to him, you know, this is for when you're an adult, right? So so that every year we can watch this Christmas tree grow. How cool is that compared to just cutting one down every year? So, you know, so, and we can nurture it. So it tells us to, I'm hoping I can look after it and it still survives. But but hopefully every year we'll see that this tree get bigger and bigger, and we'll mark the journey, you know. So I like that idea of doing that and doing it for all sorts of occasions, you know, housewarming or anniversary or celebration of job or whatever it is. Go tree, go plant.
Yeah, and in that case, if you plant a tree, you know, you don't have to worry too much about, do I do it right, if it's the right species, you know, the right density, all those technical questions you don't have to ask yourself. So it's a fun moment, and it's quite nice. And yeah, I know. The other thing I want to say is that if you have those kind of interests and you want to engage with that space, you know, look out, there is loads of organizations, loads of people doing those kind of actions and work around the globe. You're not alone. So, you know, reach out. There's a huge community in that space.
Yeah, and just drop an email. I just tell people, is that drop an email? Or even, you know, pick up a phone and call. God, someone have a conversation. Oh, yeah. It's very novel these days. but yes, totally get in contact. And if you need some help in that, you can get in contact with us at Terra Nova as well. Just drop us an email or get in touch. We'll be happy to help you connect. But yes, wonderful. We shall, as I said before, we will have the links to Fred and the work that he's been doing and is doing over the next few years so that you can help support that work. I'm sure you'll be open to connecting with people who have digital and AI skills too that may want to get inspired by you. What I want to say is a big thank you for you being on Terra Nova Earth Talks today. It's just a fascinating work that you've been doing, and I've really enjoyed hearing once again about that. And thank you for your contribution. So much gratitude for people doing work like yourself. It's incredible.
Thank you, Rose. It was a real pleasure to be on Terra Nova today and from the other side of the world. So yeah, wishing you all the best in New Zealand and really looking forward to eventually have the chance to come back again in your beautiful country.
We'd love to see you one day. Wonderful. Thanks so much, Fred. And bye
Thank
for
you,
now.
Rose.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Terra Nova Earth Talks. For more information on the content and links from this podcast, go to the Terra Nova website. That's terranova.foundation. To listen to other interviews in this series, go to the Plains FM website. That's plainsfm.org.nz. Search for Terra Nova Earth Talks. Also on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Bye for now.